This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The craft beer industry has taken off in North Carolina. In the Triangle, breweries like Full Steam, Mystery Brewing Company, and the Carolina Brewing Company, and then in the Triad, Red Oak, and Natty Greens, all of them provide a premium product for hardcore hops lovers. In some ways, small brewers benefit by the way we regulate beer. Goes back to the repeal of prohibition. Alcohol was legal again, but more tightly restricted. A three-tier system ensured that alcohol producers couldn't sell directly to consumers. Instead, they sell to distributors, who in turn sell to retailers. But microbrewers are exempt in North Carolina, and that has helped them thrive in a market that is dominated nationally by two big companies. Well, those big companies are trying to skirt the regulations to capture a larger share of the craft market. So today we're going to talk about the regulations, how they control beer sales, and what their decline might mean for North Carolina microbreweries. But first, we want to get a little history. Tim Heffernan is an independent journalist based in New York, and he recently wrote an article for the Washington Monthly on this topic and joins us now by phone. Welcome, Tom. Tim, I'm sorry. Hey, Tim.
No problem. Tom is my older brother.
Well, there you go.
Thank you for having me.
And how is he doing?
He's doing well.
Sorry. So in your article, you compare the situation in England with the situation in the United States today. And the British apparently have a drinking problem.
Yes, they do. You know, drinking is an extremely large social issue there, you know, enough that it's almost a stereotypical image of Britain right now, the so-called lager louts and lager lasses. Something like 75% of all the alcohol consumed in England is consumed by just one-sixth of the population. So there's a very ingrained, heavy drinking culture there.
And you say a lot of this has to do with just the way alcohol is regulated. Tell us about that.
Right. In a sense, it's more the way that it's not really regulated at all. In England in the post-war years, I should step back a little, both England and the United States had a temperance movement, but in the United States it led to prohibition, whereas in England it rather led in the 1930s towards encouraging people to basically pursue other healthier entertainments. But as society changed, you know, drinking became, again, more popular throughout the 1950s and the 1960s. The UK never really regulated the market for alcohol at all. It would pay very close attention, for example, to ensuring that every pint glass was a true pint, every pour of whiskey was, you know, a certain number of milliliters. But it placed very few restrictions on how the alcohol could be sold. And so, for example, the large retail stores, they have now their own versions sort of our Walmarts and Costcos. They are allowed to sell alcohol 24 hours a day. They are allowed to sell it below cost as a loss leading product to draw people into stores. Bars are allowed to offer large discounts for volume buying, all sorts of encouragements to drink, which really are not allowed in the United States.
And you talked about after prohibition, with the alcohol in the United States was flowing again, but nobody wanted to go back to the the days before prohibition with alcohol excess. So we began to regulate here in
right.
this country.
Right, exactly. Prior to prohibition, much like the UK up until today, there was very little restriction on alcohol and on how alcohol could be sold, how it could be brought from the producer to the consumer. And probably the main problem with that is that the producers had what are called tied houses. They each would literally either own a bar in a neighborhood or would sign exclusive relationships and offer discounts to a bar in a given neighborhood. And the result of that was that you had a real saturation of drinking establishments, you know, in towns and cities across the country, because every producer basically had to have their own place to sell their wares rather than a single bar that could serve the whole community a wide variety of alcohol and beer. In addition to that, there was no restrictions at all on incentivizing drinking. And so all manner of things were done, from prostitution to gambling to offering cheap loans to customers. Yeah. So the United States had an enormous drinking problem, and it was tearing apart families. And the focus of the temperance movement was to ban alcohol in the interest of social cohesion. After prohibition, it was decided that prohibition itself had obviously been a complete disaster with corruption, black markets. But we certainly didn't want to go back to what we had before. And so what was decided was that the market would be divided into what they called the three tiers, producers, distributors or wholesalers, and retailers. And those three tiers cannot form exclusive relationships with one another. They can't incentivize each other's behavior in any way. And it really was a way to ensure that no single player in that market ever got enormous financial or political power, and as a way to ensure that control of alcohol sales remained with local communities, as was enshrined in the 21st Amendment that repealed prohibition.
This is interesting to me because, in a sense, what you had before prohibition and what you still have in the UK is a kind of vertical integration, a form of monopoly control, right? I mean, the brewers can distribute and own their own bars.
Exactly.
And when we think of monopoly, we don't think of lower prices. But in fact, you say this has had the effect of lowering the price enormously in places like Great Britain, which is part of the reason they drink so much.
Yeah, it has, although I should say that argument about pricing was a kind of a narrow one, which I'd argued for a wider argument to be made in that piece and ended up not being put in. Price is one issue, but I think really the greater issue is just that when you have these monopoly conditions, and in the UK it's vertical monopoly, the producers can go all the way up to retail, they have the ability to manipulate the market in ways that greatly encourage drinking and which also just favor their own power, as against, the power of communities to regulate drinking behavior.
But when you insert middlemen in the picture, as you've done and we have done here with the three-tier system, it does, in a sense, increase the price to a certain extent, does it not?
I think that if you probably looked very finely at it, it probably does add a certain inefficiency in the system in terms of adding a middleman, a level of pricing. That said, historically, when the three-tier system was being vigorously defended and when antitrust law was being vigorously defended, there was a great diversity of alcohol products in this country, and it was also less expensive, the price was not markedly higher. There was a tremendous amount of competition.
Well, antitrust laws have not been vigorously defended in this country for some 30 years, and that has had an effect on the brewing industry, particularly at the national level. Consolidation. Basically, there are two main national brewers, big ones in this country today, right?
That's right, yeah. Briefly put, in the 30 years since antitrust regulations were basically ceased to be enforced, and that was during the early years of the Reagan administration. Anheuser-Busch has now, at this point, agglomerated with a big international company called InBev to perform Anheuser-Busch InBev. They have about 50% of the U.S. market, and Miller, which is owned by South African breweries, and Coors, which is conglomerated with Heineken in the United States, they have formed Miller Coors, which is a joint effort, and they control about 30% of the market. So all told, 80% under two companies.
All right. But they're still tied to this two-tier system. What impact has that had? Has there been any relationship between the development of the national brewing, the big brewers, and the development of the craft industry in this country?
Well, they've sort of been on parallel tracks for a long time in that they didn't really seem to interfere with one another. The big brewers really didn't have to think about or worry about this tiny craft industry and weren't terribly concerned. And they weren't terribly concerned about these little craft brews being in the same distribution networks. So your local distributor, the vast majority of their sales are going to be through with the big two firms. But if they carried a few local craft brews, no problem for the big guys. In the 1990s, as craft brewing really kind of took off and became a national force, the big brewers took a look at it and I think decided then that this was enough of a threat that they needed to begin to put their foot down and defend their territory.
And how are they doing that? Because they've got this three-tier system. The wholesalers are supposed to carry a wide variety, and they're dealing with a wholesaler. And I guess they're using market power to interfere with that in some ways.
They are, yeah. And even before that, one of the ways they've done it is by buying up a large number of craft brewers. So that's something that people should be aware of. When you say Anheuser-Busch or Miller Coors, You're not just speaking about the beers with those names on the label. They own literally hundreds of other brands, which you might assume are craft brews. Blue Moon is one that most people know, Red Hook, and those are in fact owned by those two companies, and there are many other examples. But in terms of what the big two companies have done, basically to get a hold of this distribution tier and effectively block out craft brewers from it, they have attempted to force the distributors to sign contracts of exclusivity where they say, we will only carry your products and you are not allowed to carry, you know, any other competitor product. And they have also sort of looked at a number of state laws where there are loopholes that have allowed them to either strengthen their position within distribution. I should say some states did allow the big firms to own distribution networks, but they had to be, in a sense, legally separated from the main brewer. But they've been looking at ways of kind of strengthening that relationship and increasing their position in their own sort of self-distributed networks.
And we've got 30 seconds left, but there are some states that are pushing back and challenging the big brewers, right?
Yes, there are. You know, a number of states, long and short, they've decided that they want to protect craft brewers and encourage that entrepreneurial activity. And so they're putting exceptions in for self-distribution for very small brewing outfits. The downside of that is that when these laws go through, the big brewers often say, well, the same should apply to us. You know, otherwise it's unequal treatment under the law.
We'll find out how that's playing out in the state of North Carolina in a few moments. But, Tim, I want to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Independent journalist Tim Heffernan. He wrote a piece for the Washington Monthly just recently about this very subject, which we will pursue on the State of Things when our program continues. You're listening to the State of Things on North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about how regulations affect beer distribution and how changes may affect local companies. We've been talking with independent journalist Tim Heffernan. Joining us now in the studio, two local craft brewers. Sean Lilly Wilson is the owner and chief executive optimist of Full Steam Brewery in Durham. Eric Lars Myers, founder of the Hillsboro-based Mystery Brewing Company. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks
it's
for having
great
us.
Great to be back. Sean, tell us about the craft brewing industry in North Carolina. It's really kind of exploded, hasn't it?
Yes. In the last couple of years, we've just grown enormously, so much that Eric actually wrote a book about it. And that book is... you know, if you were to rewrite that, you probably should do another book soon. It's increasing in volume, increasing in number of breweries. It's a great time to be a craft beer owner in North Carolina.
Eric, what accounts for it?
Well, I think a lot of it is just over the past few years we've seen with Pop the Cap that actually Sean put forth back about 6 years ago now. It really opened up a lot of variety into the state. And at the
tell
same,
us about Pop the Cap.
That was the law that allowed beer to be over 6% alcohol in North Carolina. It actually opened it up to 15% alcohol. And it, you know, it's not that we have a lot of really big beers coming into the state now, so much as we're getting a lot more variety into the state. And at the same time, we have a lot of population growth here from other parts of the country that already have really established beer cultures. And so we're getting variety coming in at the same time we have a lot of excitement in the state. And it's just been unparalleled growth.
And Tim Heffernan, you talked about exemptions in some states for this distribution law that basically prohibits brewers from distributing their own beer. Craft brewers are allowed to do it. They're allowed to do it here in North Carolina. Just generally, again, tell us, you know, why that's an advantage, Tim.
Well, you know, up to a certain scale, distribution is actually it's possible to do. It's efficient to do on your own. You might only need a truck or two, you know, in order to get to, you know, all of your clients in a small city. But once you get a little bit larger, you know, at the point where you're operating, you know, a fleet of trucks and hundreds of accounts, it tends to be something that's more efficient to contract out to a distributor who can provide all of those services.
Tell us, Sean, what you do now and why you're distributing your own.
Yeah, and I have to agree with Tim. We're right at the cusp of that transition and self-distributing for the first 2 years of our business, and now we're starting to take on distribution in the Charlotte market with a partner, with a wholesaler. And we still manage our own self-distribution in this local market. But I'm starting to think, you know, are we a brewery or are we a logistics channel? And and the obvious in a few years is going to, you know, the answer is going to be pretty obvious.
So, but Eric, in your study of the breweries in North Carolina, how important has that been sort of at the incubation stage, the ability to distribute? Has it been much of a factor?
I actually think it's really important for breweries to be able to self-distribute at a very young level. So this is something that we decided to do when we started up and something that I think is very important for a lot of breweries, and that is the ability to be able to define your own brand in the market. Especially because we're in such a busy market and we have so many new things coming into the market, it's really been, you know, for us, it's been very important to be able to go out and define our brand alongside all of these competitors. And I think a lot of other small breweries take advantage of that. At the same time, like Sean, we're actually about to sign a deal with a distributor and go statewide and stop being the logistics company at all because we don't want to be a trucking company. We want to make beer. That's the important part to us. And getting it out there is something that somebody else can do better.
Well, there's been an effort in this state to raise the limit, to sort of raise the number of barrels that you sell or the amount of beer that you sell in order to allow you to distribute your own. Chandi, I mean, is that valuable to you? I mean, it sounds like it might not be so important to once you get that big.
For us at Full Steam Brewery, it's not a critical matter. There are other breweries that have the position that that's very important to them. And we are a wide range of breweries in North Carolina. One of, you know, be a small nano brew pub, be a large regional brewery. So there's a wide range of opinions on the matter. I can only speak for myself that that's likely not going to be a challenge for us. And I respect the fact that there are other breweries where this is, you know, a very intense business matter for them.
I know Red Oak up in the Triad brews ale, and they talk about having to keep it cold, how wholesalers don't often, you know, don't often honor that. And so they want to keep control of the process primarily, they say, as a matter of quality control. And that would be different from somebody who doesn't have quite all those issues to deal with.
Well, I think a lot of it also has to do with money. I mean, you actually lose a lot of money off the top to have somebody else distribute your product. And so you tend to have to make a much larger portion of product and move it out in a lot more places, which, you know, which is, of course, the strength of distribution. But you do lose a significant amount of profit when you start moving through a different channel. And I think that's part of it as well.
Yeah, but it is the scale problem for you, because if you decide to become a bigger distributor, then you've got to figure out how to scale up, and that's a capital cost and all of that.
Exactly.
Well, Tim Heffernan, let's talk about what we were talking about a little bit earlier, the power, the market power of the big two brewers in this country. And you talked about a guideline, for instance, that Anheuser-Busch sends out to its distributors. Maybe I should have you talk about that, how they get along around the law, because legally they can't tell their wholesalers who to what to carry and what not to, but they've got their ways. Tell us about the guidelines.
Right. They put out a document. I don't know if they do it every year, but they certainly did it last year, called their Wholesaler Family Consolidation Guide. And this is a document where they basically lay out their philosophy of what they want from their distributors. Just up front, I should say that already Anheuser-Busch and MillerCoors have exclusive relationships with 60% of the distributors in this country. So 60% of the distributors off the top don't carry anybody else. You sign up with one or the other big two, and that's it. But for the remainder, Anheuser-Busch puts out this big document, and it says, or implies, I won't say says in no uncertain terms, but it strongly implies that if you want to continue distributing Budweiser and all the other ABI brands, you'd better get in line and support their business models. You'd better think about dropping all of your competitive brews. You need to think long and hard about whether you really want to stay in this business at all, or if you want to sell out to what they call an anchor distributor or an aligned distributor who will themselves toe the Anheuser-Busch line. So and then they offer all sorts of financing. They run their own large financing corporation, and they make it plain that, hey, if you want to sell out to one of our guys, or if you want to become one of our guys, you know, the money will be there for you to do it. So it's not a subtle document.
What impact has it had on that other 40%?
Well, you know, they tend to be quite worried to the point that many distributors really didn't want to go on record for this article because, you know, they fear that they'll turn around and be punished. But they're very concerned. A lot of these guys really want to. I mean, obviously, they want to run their business the way they see fit. They consider themselves, you know, a better judge of what will be a good business for them than Anheuser-Busch. But they are really under threat because of the size of these big two. I mean, they make up for any distributor, the vast majority of their clients and the majority of their income. And so the big brewers have real sway over them.
Sean, do you sense a threat from the big brewers? I mean, for a long time, as Tim was saying, they really didn't pay too much attention, but they seem to be now. Does it feel to you like a threat?
I think the biggest threat that I see is what Tim mentioned earlier, which is the development of the sort of the faux craft brands, those that have the appeal of craft beer. And in some cases, those that are acquisitions from the large brewers that were craft and now are under the AB or MillerCoors umbrella, when they have the distribution leverage that they do with the quality of product or the appearance of quality of craft, that puts a squeeze on the location in a zero-sum game of a grocery store shelf.
I see, for the shelf. Because I was going to say, Eric, as a consumer, you know, that does seem to be like a competitive problem. That seems to be your problem. If they put out a beer under their label, that's mass-produced, and I'm a craft beer lover, theoretically, Eric, I can tell the difference between your beer and a Busch product. So you're not going to lose me. So that's not a problem. They're just making a beer and they're putting a label on it.
Well, yes and no. I think there's a really large portion of the country that isn't a really educated consumer. I mean, you've got a very small portion of the drinking public that is that, you know, consumer that can say, oh, yeah, I know that, you know, this is a really great local craft beer and this is a craft beer knockoff. But a lot of people don't. You know, they're going in and they're seeing you know, good craft beer for, you know, one of the first times that they're trying something and it turns out to be Blue Moon and they're saying, hey, that's a really great beer. I'm going to drink that from now on and I like great beer now, but they're still just buying a Coors product. And I think there's a lot of that in the country. We, especially in the craft industry, we tend to forget that we are a very, very small portion of the overall market. 6% by volume is really not a lot at all.
But Sean, that just means that you haven't done a good enough job showing me why Blue Moon isn't a good beer, if that's what we're saying. Are we using this as our comparison and why I should drink, you know, Full Steam?
I would agree with that.
Yeah. So it's a real kind of competition problem. Tim, are there other challenges? Are there, when we get it, you know, talk about just being able to put a craft beer label, or in many cases buying what was a microbrewery and making it part of your product line as a big brewer, are there other, you know, issues in here that we should be looking at just as a matter or simply because of the size and market share these companies enjoy?
Yeah, I mean, our overall, I guess, argument with this article and then with a paper that we've also produced for the New America Foundation up here in D.C., the overall argument is that this is bad for what we call the open market. It's bad for real entrepreneurship. You know, what is often referred to as the free market, in which there's, you know, ever less regulation has led to a monopoly position of two companies in beer, in the same way that it leads to monopoly positions of just a handful of companies in many industries. And we greatly support, rather, like I said, the open market. And if you need to keep regulations in place in order to support, you know, small businesses like craft brewing, and also, again, in order to keep control over the local commerce and alcohol in those local hands, we support following those regulations.
What would those regulations look like? Does it mean ending this three-tier system and allowing sort of more open competition? Lots of head shakes here, but let me ask you, Tim, first, and then I'll talk to Sean and Eric.
No, head shakes on this end as well.
Okay, good.
We think this system has worked extremely well for almost 80 years, or did. It's kind of been forgotten, ignored, beaten down lately, and we would just like to see it brought back to the public eye and to the attention of Justice Department and other officials who can kind of enforce it.
Right. So if it's in place, you've got to enforce it. You can't use these roundabout ways to pressure distributors to take it into exclusive agreements. But what else would it take to ensure a kind of fair competition, a fair environment that would both encourage entrepreneurship and, you know, allow people to sample different beers?
I think our position as small brewers is to recognize that these rules are in place to protect the sort of the pushing of the envelope of the large breweries, and that they weren't intended to stifle the entrepreneurial startup phase of small brewers. And that's the Brewers Association's position. That's Eric and mine and a lot of other craft brewers that want to see these special recognitions for these small breweries, for us, to help us get started, to help us compete. And then as you grow, you know, there's a time to recognize that those exemptions are no longer for the small brewer, be it for federal excise limitation that's being proposed to self-distribution rights. And look at North Carolina. Here in North Carolina, we have 70 breweries because we have good regulation but good entrepreneurial opportunities for small brewers. In Georgia, maybe a third of that size. In South Carolina, the same.
Eric?
Yeah, I actually think that enforcement is a really big piece of it. I also think that it's really good to recognize that over the course of the past 70 years, a lot of the laws, especially federal laws that are in place, were actually built to protect distributors because they were the small guys versus the very large brewers, whereas now the small guys in the market are primarily the very small craft brewers, and we don't have the same kind of market push that we can against the distributors. We actually need a little bit more protection on the bottom end. Because of the pressure that's coming down from the big brewers through the distribution channels. So I think there actually needs to be protection sort of going in both ways. And then enforcement of that protection, because enforcement is really where we lack.
What would that look like, protection? How would you structure that?
Well, a lot of it is just, like we have in North Carolina, we have exemption from a lot of the laws that are protecting distributors from the big brewers. We have exemption since we're producing under 25,000 barrels. I mean, almost every brewery in the state is under 25,000 barrels. In fact, maybe all of them. And so we don't have to play by the same rules as the big guys do, which gives us a lot more freedom, which is one of the reasons that North Carolina is such a friendly place to start a brewery.
So, Tim, how would that work? Because obviously the big guys are going to say, hey, you can't do that. That's unfair competition. You're giving them an advantage. We're in business, too. This is America. Let's play fair. What would be the counter argument to that?
Well, I think just what has been said. I mean, if you want to encourage, small business and be entrepreneurial, really just practically speaking, these larger brewers are now so powerful that they can they can commit non-competitive behavior essentially, or enforce non-competitive conditions, and the only way that you can keep them from doing that is through the law. If you don't do that, they're just going to keep pushing as hard as they can. I mean, that's perfectly sensible. They are businesses; they are there to make profits, and if they can make more profit by blocking out new entries to the market, they will do it.
And they're not living hand to mouth. So if you take a look at their market share, we really haven't talked about it. We talked about the number of distributors they have, the total market share. I guess you said 80% between those two companies, right? Total beer sales. So that's a lot. And when you look at the sheer volume, you'd say, well, if things start getting rough for you, come back and talk about fair play. I suppose. So, Sean, let's talk about the number of not only brewers in this country, in this state. But that's a fair amount of jobs. And also, you're putting farmers back to work. You in particular are calling for a lot of sweet potatoes.
Oh, thank you. our mission at Full Steam is to, I call it creating a southern beer economy. We really want to take the idea of buying local to another level, to where we're supporting economically the purchasing of local ingredients and building both farmers and anywhere from the farmers to the foragers, the people who bring us handfuls of persimmons and all of that. It's a broad mission, but whether even those breweries that don't have a mission to buy local ingredients, they are supporting the local economy through a good relationship with a wholesaler, through growing retailers and all that. So down the chain here, there's a lot of growth that I think we can all enjoy that's locally driven.
Not to mention weakening the judgment of local consumers. It's a joke. It's a joke. And the barley industry, too. I mean, I guess they're growing more barley in the state of North Carolina.
Absolutely. Yeah, we are Riverbend Malt House's largest customer, and we're transitioning our flagship beer, the Full Steam Southern Lager, to a North Carolina grain bill, so it's going to use 90% of the grain is going to be North Carolina grown six-row barley, just like our El Toro is. So we're excited about those developments, and frankly, that's come a lot quicker than we thought it would. And that's really exciting to see.
Eric, I know you're making a study of the industry as well as the craft of making beer. What's the horizon for? I mean, are there more on the way? Or people excited about the industry?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of breweries on their way starting up in North Carolina. And I actually think this is why you see a lot of ingredients starting to be grown here. There's a lot of enthusiasm for the craft market in the state. And that in turn sort of creates opportunity in the rest of the economy, in the agriculture and in distribution. There's a lot of craft-only distributors now. There's a lot of people who are looking at growing hops and more barley in North Carolina and really trying to support the industry in many, many ways. And so it's not just, you know, somebody making beer. It's this overall large economy, both through agriculture and through distribution and through retail, that's an enormous economic push that can really help the state grow and, you know, come out of this economic slump we've been in and everything. It's a huge opportunity across many industries, just having a bunch of small entrepreneurs chasing their dreams.
And Tim, as you said, the big guys are doing just what corporations do. I mean, they're using their power to, you know, get the advantage that they feel they have a right to. How successful are they? Are they making any progress in changing regulations so they don't have to do these end runs?
They're being generally extremely successful. I mean, of course, they're operating in an environment that for three decades now has been largely pro-deregulation, so they have that advantage anyway. Just some recent cases, or I'll give you one anyway. Anheuser-Busch they'd had a stake in the largest distributor in the Chicago area for years. Again, this was a law that was sort of grandfathered in after Prohibition, where brewers were allowed to retain, I believe it was up to a 5% stake in a distributor. But they'd had 30% in this distributorship. Long case, it was being fought before the Illinois Liquor Board, and ABI just won. So now they've been allowed to retain that 30% stake. But, you know, it should be seen as establishing a precedent, both in Illinois and probably elsewhere when they bring similar lawsuits. So, yeah, they are not feeling they haven't been significantly threatened yet.
We will keep our eyes on the story in this state of North Carolina. Tim Heffernan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tim Heffernan, an independent journalist based in New York. You can read his article, Last Call, at WashingtonMonthly.com. Sean Lilly Wilson, owner and chief executive optimist of the Full Steam Brewery Company in Durham. Learn more about him at fullsteam.ag. Eric Lars Myers, founder of the Hillsboro-based Mystery Brewing Company, and you can check out mysterybrewing.com. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, Christmas lullabies, opera style, on the State of Things. Stay tuned.